Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome all you wiretappers out there. I'm here on the Skype, and we're going to put this up as a podcast with our good friend Larry Henry from Northwest Arkansas, late of Las Vegas. Used to be a newsman out in Las Vegas during a lot of the mob stuff. He covered it. He knows a lot of people out there, and he writes a blog. It's a mob and popular culture for the Mob Museum out there in Las Vegas. And so you need to go to the Mob Museum website. I think it's... what is it? Welcome, Larry. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Gary. Always good to see you in person and on Skype.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's themobmuseum.org. And okay. Yeah, so thank you for mentioning that. In fact, as you know, I was just out in Las Vegas recently for the world premiere of Mobtown, the new movie coming out.
Yeah.
Your podcast on the Appalachian Summit, which just aired, nor on your website, Gangland Wire. Perfect timing, because that whole Appalachian issue, Gary, is really popping up with your podcast with that new movie. So a fascinating topic.
Sure, with that Irishman coming out, there's a huge amount of interest in mafia stuff. And you know, that mob town, I've been wondering whatever happened to that. You're gonna fill us in on some of that, I know, because you're getting ready to release a piece on that. See, I did... A year ago, I saw a blurb on Facebook that said they were making this movie, and I could tell it was an A movie. It wasn't a B movie. It had name actors in it, and a studio had a budget and good high production values, and so I knew it was going to be, it should have been released, and then I made a Appalachian Convention two-part series for my podcast, and I sat on it, and they didn't release it. And then it came up, November 14th was the anniversary of Appalachian meeting. And so I thought, well, they're going to release it on November the 14th. And I watched, and nothing was coming out. So I went ahead and released my podcast. I didn't know if they're ever going to release that movie. So I went ahead and put out my podcast telling about the convention. And you know, we did the Mob Film Festival that weekend, the night that my premiere of my new movie, Brothers Against Brothers, was on the anniversary of the Mafia Convention, November the 14th. So I like to think that'll bring me luck, maybe. Who knows? But Larry, tell us a little bit about why did it take so long for that movie to get out?
Well, it's just part of making the movie and putting it together. It's funny, Gary, because I do want to talk about your new documentary, which is outstanding. And first, let's talk about Mobtown, which dovetails with your Appalachian Summit podcast with the former Kansas City Police Sergeant, Kate Kozol.
Yeah.
She's great. That was a great podcast. Anyway, so out in Las Vegas at the end of the month, end of November, the Mob Museum in their courthouse, which the Kefauver hearings were held in the 50s in that courthouse in the museum, used to be a post office in Las Vegas. As you know, Gary, you and I were there for the first Mob World Summit up in that building. So they had a world premiere for that new movie, Mobtown, which is out in December for wide release, and it was fantastic. It was it was the world premiere. They had the director, a guy who goes by the name Danny A, who's in The Irishman, by the way, and is an actor and a director. And David Arquette is in it. You know, Jamie Lee Sigler, who was Meadow Soprano, is in the movie. Now, some of the actors and the director and the screenwriter were up on stage at the Mob Museum premiere in late November. It was fantastic, and they showed the movie. There was an invitation-only a crowd of people there who watched it. It was fantastic. It really hit. Later, I was talking to the screenwriter about it, and he said, it's interesting because no one's ever really done anything big on the Appalachian Summit. It's been touched on here and there. I think Analyze This touched on it a little bit in the beginning, that comedic movie. But it's really a really strong movie. It does a lot of things. It gets into what really happened at the summit, as your podcast does. And it really plays into the sort of a hero story with that sergeant, that state trooper sergeant, Croswell, who's played by David Arquette, who's kind of put off by his superiors and, you know, a lot of people in power, lawyers, judges, police officials, sort of give the mob a free run up there. This is in Appalachian, as you know, Gary, about 200 miles northwest of New York City by the Pennsylvania border, right. This little town where Joe Barbera, Joe the Barber, had his house, and they had this summit of 100 or so mob members. Anyway, mob leaders, by the way. So anyway, it's an interesting twist on the mob story. It's this police sergeant story and his sidekick, beautifully played by P.J. Byrne, real funny comedic element. But they're also, they did a lot of different things in the movie, Gary. They had a lot of comedy in it, not a lot of bloodshed. It's not the typical, quote, mob movie.
Right.
A lot of strong women characters. You know, the mob movie industry is criticized a lot for not really, for stereotyping women. Yeah. So I think you're going to see a lot different in this movie that I think people are going to like a lot.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, there really wasn't a shooting. It was more the story of what happened afterwards. It was a pivotal moment, Larry. I mean, I thought Bill Owsley, the retired agent, yeah. Bill Owsley has been on my show several times, and he'll say, you know, that the FBI, he said, he won't criticize J. Edgar Hoover at all. He won't say anything bad about him. He'll say, you know, he said, Mr. Hoover didn't really pay much attention to the mob before that. And then after that meeting, he said, then they started paying a little bit of attention. They realized that this is something we need to look at, and they created the Top Hoodlum Squad in every major city. And he was one of the early members of the Top Hoodlum Squad here in Kansas City. You know, what's the agent, Bill Romer, up in Chicago? He kind of pioneered that whole let's go after the mob by the tough FBI agents up in Chicago with their Top Hoodlum Squad. So that's, you know, in mob lore, shall we say, that was such a pivotal moment. It was never the same after the Appalachian meeting.
They really began to push it. It's funny because I think until then, until that November 1957 meeting up north of New York City, northwest of New York City, I think the FBI had 400 agents assigned to, quote, subversives,
yeah,
communists and all that. And only four to yeah, organized crime figures. And then after that summit, Gary, it's in the movie. It's beautiful. These guys, they're all up at Joe the Barber Barbera's home, beautifully played by David A., by the way, the director. Danny A., I'm sorry, the director. So they all scatter when they realize they're being watched, and there's a roadblock out. They scatter, and Nick Civella was there, by the way, from Kansas City. So they all scatter, and so after that, and they were all arrested. It was not all. I think 60-some-odd of the 100 were arrested. But anyway, after that, yeah, it just really blew up, and the whole focus by the FBI on the mob finally began to really pick up steam. And after that, Robert Kennedy with his Get Hoffa Squad, and that whole focus really picked up, Gary.
Yeah, it was amazing. That was, and you know that Joe the Barber dude, he had this cover going up there, and I think a lot of the local people didn't question anything about him. He had a business. It was a soft drink bottling company up there in upstate New York, and kind of you know, lived the life of a country gentleman. But he had would have had a decent stream of income coming in from that, and so he had the perfect cover. And I grew up in the country, and you know, you a guy like that, you just, you know, say, well, he's some guy from the city, and you don't pay much attention to him. I'm surprised that state trooper I know there's a whole backstory I talked about in my podcast, because the state trooper already kind of knew who he was dealing with. He didn't just stumble into that, did he? Did they deal with that in the movie? Or maybe we don't want to give away too much.
Yeah, they did. No, it's a great movie, man. I really enjoyed the movie. It's I think the real life guy, Sergeant Croswell, I think was 44-year-old guy. Again, beautifully played by David Arquette. Great job. Again, kind of a Rocky Balboa story, kind of a hero story. He was kind of a not seen, not taken seriously. Yeah, kind of he overheard some conversation, I think, by Barbera's son about some hotel rooms. And he was kind of a car nut, and he saw all these fancy cars in town. And so, and then he gave a beautiful, beautiful scene, an actor named Stevie Gutman, who plays this. So Barbera goes out and has to get all this meat, fish, all this kind of stuff in town for the event and begin to really order it all. So he goes into this fish store and starts to try to order all the fish, and it's just a real funny scene as that unfolds. And meanwhile, later on, the state trooper sergeant goes into a restaurant, tries to order a steak, tries to order. Everything's been taken already because they're using Barbera's big event. So yeah, the screenwriter later told me a lot of that's really based on what really happened, that they dried up all the meat and fish and food in town for this big cookout that they were going to have. It was supposedly, you know, Vito Genovese, after it was not long after Albert Anastasia was shot down at that barbershop and hotel on 7th Avenue in New York, that Genovese decided, let's all get together and figure out where we're going in the future in terms of leadership roles, in terms of the heroin trade and all that. And so, by the way, I have to say Vito Genovese is played beautifully in that movie by Robert Davi. So I think you're going
to
like the movie a lot, Gary.
I'm anxious to see that one because, like you said, it's not really been dealt with in the popular culture and popular media other than as kind of a sidelight, you know, like in Goodfellas, Ray Liotta talked with, you know, just his voiceover as Henry Hill. And he's talking about how everything changed after he called it the Appalachian Convention, which most people do. Most people, I always call it the Appalachian Convention, but Bill Owsley straightened me out. He always called it the Appalachian Convention, which is the way you're supposed to pronounce it.
Well, it was funny because on your podcast, that was really funny when you got into the whole pronunciation and you said that Bill told you what to do. Because in the movie, this actor, Robert Davi, singer, I think he does a lot of Sinatra tunes and that sort of thing. But in the movie, great job. I mean, he has the look playing Genovese. And there's a funny scene. There's a lot of comedy, and it's not a comedy, but there's a lot in the movie that's funny. And one of the things funny is the Genovese character sort of stumbles over. You know, here's this big, powerful mob figure, and he stumbles over how to pronounce the name, too. So the whole Appalachian pronunciation even comes up in the movie.
It would be funny, yeah.
They dealt with that, yeah, because everybody fumbles with it.
Interesting.
Well, you mentioned, by the way, Garrett, I'm going to cut you off, but you mentioned the Barbera home up in the sort of remote area. It reminds me, and I know we'll talk about it in a second, but it reminds me of your new documentary with Spiro. The Spiro guy who lived up, I forget the name of the town, Gary, lived up in a remote area outside of Kansas City. And as you were saying in your documentary, and some of the Civella crime family were saying, I know I'm jumping around, but they were saying that house way out in the country that Spiro was in was hard to sit on. It was hard to monitor. So, yeah, so you get like Barbera up there in that remote place, and they thought they were in a secluded area until the roadblock got set up.
And he was smart enough to set up that roadblock because I'm telling you, you've never done this, I'm sure, but I have. You go into something, and there's a lot of people, and there's just a few of you, and all of a sudden they just start, like a covey of quail, they just start sprinting away or jumping in cars and leaving, and you're out there, you don't really know what you got. You're standing there, you know, and you can't run people down. You can grab one, but you can't grab 10. So he was smart enough, which Kate and I talked about, to smart enough to set roadblocks out there. So when they did, you know, take off in their cars, then they could stop them out on the road. So it was, the tactics were great, by the way, by Sergeant Creswell.
Yeah, it wasn't. As Kate said in your podcast, I remember that line Kate said about all those mobsters, and you know, heavyweight mobsters. I think mob figures from 13 states. You had Carlos Marcello and, you know, Nick Savelle. I mean, you had all the New York top mobsters. As Kate said in your podcast, Gary, that must have been a sight to see. With the alligator shoes and the fancy suit. And I think some of them had some crazy, you know, they said, well, we were just out looking for real estate to buy out in the woods and stuff like that.
One guy said he was feeling ill, and he was up in the neighborhood, and he knew that his friend, Joe Barbara, lived up there, so he just went by.
just wanted to drop by. He had 100 other top mobsters.
Savelle and Joe Filardo, who was with him, actually say, we surmise, you'll never know this for sure, that Joe Filardo, who was the old school mobster from the 30s and 20s and nationally known, he was kind of the power behind the throne by then. He was there to introduce Nick Savelle as the new boss of Kansas City, make this formal, and he was the out front boss. You know, Kansas City, kind of like Chicago, they had an out front boss. They had Sam Giancana, but Tony Accardo was always in the rear. Even had other bosses, even up to IUPA. You know, they still had Tony Accardo back in the back. Who was it? There's another couple of guys. Paul
IUPA,
Riga.
You had IUPA
Paul,
in there.
Was in the back. They were like behind the scenes. And they were kind of the ultimate authority. Well, in Kansas City, Joe Filardo did that really almost up till he died for Nick Savelle. Nick was the boss, but Joe Filardo was the power behind the throne. So he was up there because he was old school, and he knew those guys back from the Prohibition days, and you know they would listen to him, and he was there to introduce Nick Savelle. And that narcotics thing, is it? It's always been the myth, shall we say, or the rumor, the theory that they were there, and that was one of the main reasons they were there, is to how to deal with whether they should get in the narcotics business or stay in it, because they were already in it. And actually, you know, the Joe Bonanno family stayed in it with Carmine Galante, you know, all the way through. Is there any real factual basis to that or any solid information, do you know?
Apparently so. You know, I think one of the things that sort of led to, you know, Genovese's power move, Gary, as you know, is, and this is in the movie, the attempted killing of Costello, Frank Costello, which led to him, you know, our friend Casey McBride, the Costello expert, would say that led to Costello's retirement. Then Anastasia, as I understand it, the control of the docks and how the heroin was coming in from Marseille, France, and Montreal and places like that. I think part of that control of the docks that Anastasia had also led to Anastasia being knocked off because of the importation and distribution and who was going to control the distribution of the heroin. Now, the movie doesn't get a lot into the heroin issue. It's more of a, if at all, as I recall, it's more of a hero story. It's an interesting twist, Gary, as an intelligence officer yourself. It's an interesting twist where it focuses, and speaking of humanizing, it humanizes the police officers. Yeah. And it's kind of from their story more, Gary, than it is Genovese and the mobsters, Joey Gout. You got it shows the killing of Anastasia, so you got a little gunplay. It has the attempted killing of Costello, but then it's really a human interest story about that police officer and how he overcame a lot of he was pushed aside and wasn't, you know, taken seriously and all that. And so it's an interesting twist on, you know, quote the mob movie, because it humanizes the police side of it.
That I thought I was the only one that did showed the police side of stories. Most people just show the mobster side.
I think that's true, and this movie gets at that, and Arquette does a good job, and again his sidekick, just a beautiful job by this guy PJ Byrne, who was you know, he was in, he's been in a lot of movies and a lot of television shows, Wolf of Wall Street and things like that. So, good movie, Gary. I think you're going to like it. Now, meanwhile, so a couple of other things going on. Speaking of the Mob Museum and Kansas City, if you don't mind me sort of segueing off of that, I had a good time the other day. The latest blog post I did on Ernest Hemingway, and I thought a lot about you when I did this, Gary, because as you know, and you know better than anybody, Hemingway got his start in Kansas City in 1917, And it's, as you have said and written about, even that early, the Black Hand and the organized crime in Kansas City was an active force back then. So one of the things I tried to point out is that Hemingway's experience in Chicago and Kansas City as a reporter at the Kansas City Star led to his knowledge of how the underworld works in some degree and in the writing of his short story, The Killer. So a lot of that Kansas City background that, that you've written and talked about also affected his view.
Yeah, I read
his
that. It's interesting, yeah. I don't really think about how Hemingway, you know, the famous, most famous writer in some areas, if you will, really made his bones, shall we say, in Kansas City and learned how to write and really got into that seamy underbelly of life, which, you know, that was part of his thing. He liked to know about the seamy underbelly of life and you know, men and struggles and killing and all that. Then they went on to World War One to learn even more about that kind of that side of life, and he got real life experience there to help him write those later stories.
Well, as you know, man, it was this the old Star building is, what is it, Grand, Gary, where the old Star is. It's still there, the building that Hemingway worked in. And as you've written about and talked about, I mean, Kansas City, and you've done a magnificent job of bringing this to the forefront, and we'll fast forward to the present at some point. But, you know, Kansas City back then in those World War One years and beyond was a open town, man. It was, you know, the jazz joints and the gambling dens and the prostitution and all that. And Hemingway covered crime for the Kansas City Star. So he saw a lot of that. By the way, several years ago, I went by that old Star building and the guard let me in where the newsroom, where Hemingway worked. There's a plaque on the wall where all the Star, somebody needs to go get that, Gary. I thought about that because I think they're trying to redo that building. There's a plaque that says all the Star employees that went to World War One. And Hemingway's name is on that plaque. Somebody needs to get that.
They probably have. They're making it, or they'll incorporate it. They're making it into condos, kind of a multi-use building, so you can live there now.
Interesting.
You'll move to Kansas City. You can rent a car or buy a condo there.
Right. We need to make it a museum, Gary.
Museum,
we need to turn
Kansas
it into
City.
A mob museum. We need to turn. Let's pull our unlimited
pull
resources.
$2.95. Go buy the building.
Let's see if we can get it for $3,000 if we pool our resources. But Kansas City, you know, the Hemingway era, all that, and then into where you, what you write about, Gary, if you don't mind me pumping up and plugging, it's absolutely imperative that everybody get your new documentary, Gary's first documentary, Gangland Wire, about the which has rare surveillance audio that exposed the Kansas City Las Vegas connection. This new one that just came out by Gary, the battle with the brothers against the brothers. It's the Spiro and Savella clan battle for control, right, Gary, of organized crime in Kansas City.
That's what it's about, you know. I was working it during that time. I just gotten transferred into the intelligence unit. And one of my early interviews really was with a guy who told me, and I couldn't believe he was telling me this. He said, he said, Carl Sparrow, he tried to get me to join his organization. I said, well, what do you mean? He said he was going to move in on the Savellas and I need to meet up, I need to join up with him. And he said he was going to buy a bar and it was going to have a back room and we were going to have our meetings back there. I mean, it sounded like, our gang, our clubhouse. It was like a bunch of little boys in a way. I didn't really believe it until, you know, over the years I realized that was what was going on, because other things that guy told me and another guy told me just started, you know, playing out right in front of us. I didn't really believe him at first, but yeah, it was a strong move on the young Turks, shall we say, Carl, Mike, and Joe Spiro, to move on the established Savella organization, which had, you know, been in control since the 50s, since 57 for sure at the Apalachin Convention, and even before that. I mean, they were old school right out of they were the young guys during Prohibition. So, it is quite a story. It was, because it was quite a battle. We had bodies dropping and bombs going off everywhere for about a year. Kind of a parallel, if you will, to the Cleveland situation during that time with the Irish guy, Green, Danny Green.
Thank you. Green,
kind of
yeah,
a parallel
yeah, yeah.
with the young Turks and the old guard were clashing, and the old guard, you know, ends up winning in the end. So we won't spoil the ending, but let's just say that it's kind of hard to displace the old guard.
Well, and I love what you have in there. You got former law enforcement officers like yourself who covered it, driving around to the actual sites. You at the, it's like Bill Owsley, the FBI special agent in charge during that period, says in your documentary, every town has a social club where these guys play poker, play cards, socialize, plot crimes, and you're out there in front of the one, the Trap in Kansas City, bombed in the back, in one of their. I don't think there's a city in the country, Gary, and you know, I may be off with this, that had as many bombings during that short period of time. I mean, this war really, and I may be oversimplifying it, the Nick Savella established, made men, put on the map at the Appalachian Summit versus these young, as Savella called them, hippies, or Tuffy DeLuna called them hippies. The bombings and the killings blew up the one guy in his wheelchair. Just an incredible.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, story of revenge and counter revenge and bombings. Unbelievable. Unbelievable story.
On the side of the Spiros, they were a little bit like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Because they started recruiting. They were recruiting non-Italians into their little gang and recruited these Peckerwoods. We call them Peckerwoods if you're not Italian in Kansas City. Recruited these Peckerwoods in, and in one of the, I didn't have the actual tapes because they were never put in as evidence. And if they're not put in as evidence, they're destroyed. But I had the transcript from some actual tapes. So I hired actors to just impersonate Nick and Carl Savella talking about their different plans and their problems in this war with the Spiros. And so, you know, to hear them talk about, you know, how we're going to get these guys. And it's just, you know, it was a pretty amazing time. And another thing is, like Nick Savella said, you know, he said they tried to kill Carl once, and that's when they paralyzed him. He said, you know, the guy didn't die. Now everything's different. And that's when they went to the bombs, because it's used so hard you can't get close enough to shoot somebody with a gun. So you got to go to the bombs then. And then they have to go to the remote control detonated bombs, because mob guys, they know the value of or the problems of collateral damage with a bomb. So you got to get some kind of a bomb that's just going to get your guy and not, you know, school kids walking by or something like that.
It was great, man, because I have to say again, I don't think anybody in the business is doing better documentaries than you, Gary. This is a really superb documentary. I highly recommend everybody get it, because Kansas City's mob wars, I don't think there's a more interesting story in the country, and Gary beautifully tells it. But it's really funny because it's kind of like you say, Gary, it's kind of a madcap. They kept trying to blow up cars, and they would try to blow up Tuffy DeLuna's car outside of the Villa Capri.
Yeah.
Didn't work, and it, you know, because the informant said the remote control device was on and on and on, just the whole thing. But then some of the bombs did work. I also thought I love the way you humanized, speaking of humanizing, we're talking about Mobtown. I love the way you humanized that, Gary, when you talked about one night you were on surveillance and you were driving around in that area near these places where these guys hung out, and up next to you pulls a car full of mob guys, Savella family guys, and Tuffy DeLuna. Would tell the story.
He was weird watching Carl Spiro, who they were trying to kill, and I saw this. There's two or three of us, and we saw this car we didn't know with a bunch of like three or four people in it, and they kept driving by the tavern, drove by two or three times, and their target, Carl Spiro, was in there by himself. There wasn't anybody else even in the bar except the bartender. And so, you know, I go get closer because we can't just let him run in and shoot him up and then try to catch him afterwards. I mean, that's, it was such a dicey time for us. And we didn't, you know, we're asked, we're calling in saying, well, what do we do? And, you know, we sit back, we wait, you know, we got to use, you know, choose your own common sense, your own judgment at that point in time, because nobody down at the office can tell you what to do. And so I drive up a little closer just to see exactly who this is. And they start following me, and we get about 4 or 5 blocks away, and they pull up next to me at a light. So I'm sitting there at the traffic light, and all of a sudden, I just feel somebody staring at me. And as the light changed, I just made a little quick glance over. Seemed like a normal, you know, kind of a normal look over. And there's Tuffy Luna just staring at me, and he gives me about a half a grin. And it's like he knows, because here I am, a 32-year-old white guy with, you know, in kind of a nondescript car in that neighborhood, and it was primarily an African-American neighborhood. By then, but we got 4 or 5 blocks over, I'm driving over in the African-American neighborhood, and people don't usually do that, like that look like me. they knew right then, he knew.
were you worried at some point? Now, you mentioned that you guys had your badges, because at what point do you think, because these are some pretty bad customers. I mean, yeah, these are some rough guys. In fact, wasn't Tuffy suspected to be one of the ones who went into that Virginia Tavern and shot one of the Sparrows, or shot it up. But were you worried that at some point, late at night, prowling around a car, he might think you were one of the Sparrow guys and start firing away on you guys? I mean, what point thinking, you know what, we better show some badges.
If you get mistaken by the other team, shall we say, for the other team, there's always a certain risk to that. You just have to be careful, and you know, I wasn't so afraid of any Sevilla people because they were older, more mature, and less likely to be scared and jump. But some of these guys that Carl Spiro had around him, they were younger, they were not even Italian, and they were, you know, heavy drinkers and druggers, and you know, they're likely to jump. Those are the ones that really worried me. I had a couple of them chase me for a little bit one time when I was watching Carl Spiro, and I ran a red light, and they got caught behind another car. So I got onto the highway and hit the highway, and they never caught up with me.
It just took off. Now, I love how you found the, you know, you told both sides of the story. You didn't try to make one side, you know, favor one side or the other. You went and found that lady who had told some fascinating stories about that strip bar out on Kansas City, Kansas, the Red Apple, where the Spiro clan sort of hung out. And her side of the story, how did you track down somebody who hung out with and drank with the Sparrows?
And, you know, I did that for Nick Sevilla, too. I found that lawyer, Phil Cardarella.
Yes, Nick, that was great.
He was in both my movies, and he talked some personal stuff about Nick, what kind of a person he was, you know, not as a criminal, but as a man. And I think that's important to show that they're not one-dimensional characters. They have wives and families. That's the thing I always liked about working the mob, is they got regular lives. They're just not all stoned on Dilaudid or Percocet or Oxycontin or heroin all the time. Then they run out and steal and go sell that and go get some more drugs. They've got wives and families and regular lives. Their kids go to school at St. Pius at the nice Catholic high school up north, and they know each other. They're part of the community. And so I liked showing them, and so he showed that. And the Spiro brothers were the same way. They were just on a little different economic level. They were a little bit lower in financially and economic level, but they had wives and families. And that lady, she was married to a guy whose daughter was married to Carl Spiro for a while, and Carl actually adopted that lady's son when they got married. And she had been at the last mob film fest we had. She's been interested in this stuff, and I've had a comment from her before on one of my blog pieces on my website. You can make comments, and I had a comment from her stepson, who had been the brother to Carl's wife, who had died of accidental, she inhaled a piece of meat or a piece of food and choked on it and died. And he's wanted to talk to me, and he never would follow through, but she follows through. And I've talked to her a couple, three times. And then when I made this movie, I hadn't thought about her for a long time. And I'm making this movie, and all of a sudden she makes another comment, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to hit her up and see what happens. I remember she was not really a criminal at the time, shall we say. Those people that were professional criminals, when you hit them up to talk on camera, they get hinky. They don't really like to talk on camera. They're just so schooled in that. And I've tried to get several of them, but most of them won't do it. But she was never a criminal. She has a really interesting backstory, if you want to hear that I think. But she, yes. She said, yeah, I'd be happy to go on there. And, you know, she was a gold mine of information. She knew all the brothers. I could tell you a lot more about how well she knew some of those brothers, but I told her I wouldn't repeat this other stuff out in public. But she knew them really well and had known them for a long time. And so I told her after we got done, I said, you know, Sharon, I wish I'd have known you back in the day, because I think she was pretty hot back in the day. I had another guy tell me he knew her back in the day and said she was hot. Plus, I think I could have gotten information out of her because she knew a lot.
did she work at that Red Apple Bar?
She worked at another bar owned by a mob associate, a guy named Sophie Rinaldo downtown. She worked at that bar for a long time. But the side story on her, which I found fascinating, she ended up, you know, she works in a downtown bar. She's pretty well known. She's not a criminal. She doesn't have, you know, her direct people are not criminals. Her husband was a truck driver in the Teamsters Union, but he was not a criminal. He was just a truck driver. And her other family were not criminals particularly. And she ended up getting a job as an administrative assistant for one of the circuit court judges down over in the courthouse. She probably met somebody that was an administrator or somebody over in the courthouse. And I mean, it's county politics. I mean, it's not as bad as Cook County, but it's county politics. And you know somebody and they want to take care of you, well, they might get you a job. And, you know,
she worked at the courthouse. Wow.
She wasn't the kind of person who was going to go out and you know, rat people out particularly, but she did do one thing. She had a big heart. She had a huge, big heart.
Yeah.
And she had a person come in and say that her son or her brother or something was in the penitentiary convicted, but there's a DNA test that they've run and it shows that he was not guilty. But somehow they did, or they believe he's not guilty and they want to get the the DNA test run. And she doesn't know how to get that done.
Yeah.
And she didn't have a lawyer, and there is an innocence project, but Sharon decided she'd just help her herself. And she said, well, we just had one come through here, and she prints off a motion. She said, here's a copy of the motion that you file. Now, if you just go back and retype this and then put the right names in there and just file it pro se without a lawyer, why, you'll get the DNA test. So she did that, and it proved out. He was not guilty, and he got released. He was exonerated. But it came out during this process, it came out that she'd done that, that Sharon had done that. And one of the bigger rules in the circuit court was for the court staff to not help anybody on either side of whether it's the prosecution or the defendant or either party in the civil suit. You just you can give them information about, you know, this filing's here, you know, there's a due date coming up here or something like that. But you can't here's a copy of a motion that you just copy this and file it. You can't, it's like practicing law without a license. And the judge fired her for it, even though the guy was found not guilty. He fired her.
Wow.
I think he felt like he didn't have a choice.
Wow.
It must have come out, I don't know exactly how it came out, but it must have come out that the judge could not enforce the rule. So interesting little side story on Sharon, and she had a lot of interesting little tidbits on the Spiro brothers.
Well, you do a great job of finding people, not only the surveillance audio and the court records. I've always said this, your book, I've got the hard copy and the ebook copy of Leaving Vegas, your book about the Kansas City Las Vegas connection. And in the ebook, you've got those links to the documents, but you've always been great about finding people. This new one, with those, you know, you've got law enforcement people, you've got her, really tells that story beautifully of that young upstart group, the Sparrows, trying to knock out the entrenched, older, hardcore Savella crime family and how it just didn't work, because those Savellas, man, those guys were hardcore. I mean, they you talk about blowing people up. In fact, I know you and I have talked about this, and Frank Collada, you and Frank have both expressed that there may be some reason to believe that it was the Kansas City people behind blowing up Lefty's car in Las Vegas, Lefty Rosenthal, because, as some of your audio shows, the Kansas City family was upset that he was drawing so much heat on himself, and that Kansas City mode of attack through bombs was...
That was something else. I mean, they had somebody, and I think it was one guy by the end that was really he was their bomb maker, because there's two bombs. I got an ATF agent that's in the movie who worked two of the attempts on Carlsboro before they actually ended it, and they were built. They were able to recover them unexploded, and they were built by the same person. So then they get him with a third bomb. So there, and a third bomb was there wasn't enough left of it to really say conclusively it was the same person, but it had a lot of similarities. It was remote detonated and had a large amount of explosives, bigger than what they really needed, and so there was three in a row at the last two years before they killed him. And it wasn't long. That was 1984, and it wasn't long after that. I don't remember when they tried to get Lefty, but it wasn't long after 1984 that they tried to get Lefty.
Well, it was I can't imagine what the people in Kansas City must have thought during that period when buildings were being blown up in the River Key and cars were being blown up. People must have thought, man, this is what's going on. You know, I mean, bombs going up all the time.
The bombing scared people so bad they had that really nice entertainment district, if you will, that everybody in the city loved. To this day, when there's a Kansas City History Buffs Facebook page, it's got about 15,000 people on it. To this day, all I have to do. And what I did just before our film festival, I started posting pictures from the River Key, and they'll just go nuts on it. They will link, and they will comment, and they will share, and they just love the River Key, those all of us of a certain age that are interested in that time. They blew that place up, basically. They scared everybody off. As my Gangland Wire movie got a guy in there that was working down there at the time. He said after the last explosion and one building got blown up, he said people just quit coming down. They just stopped immediately. And he lost his job and his place closed down. And all the rest of them just closed down within the next two or three months.
I was there a couple years ago talking to some younger people in one of the coffee shops. Now, you know, it's... Some places are coming back in that empty space where that big explosion was. Some of the younger barista, you know, some of the people working in that coffee shop were telling me they learned a lot about what had happened back there from your website, because, you know, they're so young that was all a part of, they weren't even born when all that stuff was happening. So, hey, I got to say,
go ahead, Gary, sorry. There's a house built where that big explosion was, that whole building went down. And there's a house built, it's mainly parking lot now, and they took out the street, they closed down the street and made it all into parking lot. But in the edge of that parking lot, there's a big, nice, modern-looking, beautiful home built down there. And the guy approached me, and he said, he told me where he lived. He said, now, I think that explosion was right there behind my house. I said, that explosion was practically, your house is practically sitting on top of where that hole was.
I think I know what you're talking about. Is it that blue house? It's kind of like a blue two-story.
It's on Delaware. I know what you're talking about. Just a block off of the main drag down through there, Delaware. It's really modern looking. It's kind of out of place. It's like there's no other houses. It looks like a house sitting in the middle of a bunch of buildings. So.
Well, listen, I got to say one more thing about Kansas City. We need to... This summer, when we have our Mob World Summit in Kansas City, we need to get down to the River Key. But also, one more interesting tidbit I just have to mention, sort of out of the blue. I've been reading, you mentioned the Irishman. I've been reading a book about Hoffa called In Hoffa's Shadow by a Harvard law professor named Jack Goldsmith, whose stepfather was Chucky O'Brien, one of the suspects who supposedly... So anyway, fascinating book. I did not know this until I'm about halfway through it now. Chucky O'Brien was born in Kansas City, and his mother Sylvia, who made all the connections with the mob characters up in Detroit for Hoffa and all that, was also from Kansas City. I didn't know that.
I knew there was a Kansas City connection. I think maybe he has his son, or there's still some relatives around here. I had a guy tell me recently that he knew one of the relatives of Chuckie O'Brien. So I didn't really explore that very much. Might be something odd. Maybe I can get him come on the podcast.
Yeah, especially with all that Hoffa stuff real big right now. Of course, Chuckie O'Brien, his involvement is or whether he was or wasn't involved.
I think he was an unwitting dupe myself. I may be wrong. I don't know what kind of guy he was, but he might have just been they might have duped him into doing that. Because those mob guys, they're slick, man. They know that you got to put a guy at ease before you're going to get him isolated, especially a guy like Jimmy Hoffa. And whoever they're going to hit, you got to put him at ease and get him to willingly go to some place where there's no witnesses and there's no chance of escape, where they can really do it and do it quietly. And to get you, that means you got to get a friend. You got to get somebody who will put him at ease enough that he feels safe, that like they won't kill me now because, you know, here my stepson's here with me. So, you know, they probably duped him into taking him over there and then dropped him off then the kid's trapped, you know. I mean, he may be sitting out in front, or he drives away, and he's going to come back after he gets a call, because he can't be in this meeting. And you know, what's he going to do? He have to go into witness protection.
And unbelievable, and unbelievable that to this day now, Dan Moldea, the investigative journalist who wrote the book, a book in the 70s, The Hoffa Wars, and Eric Shawn of Fox News now, I've got some new developments.
I haven't really looked into it yet, but I'd seen some kind of a headline or something about that on Facebook, I guess.
Yeah, Dan might be a good podcast. It's you know, their take is Dan's take is Sal Bergoglio, one of the New Jersey mobsters, was the actual shooter, and then they took Hoffa in a 55-gallon drum to a site in New Jersey where they think they've located, or the general area that they think it is. So there's more to come, more big news to come.
Sal Bergoglio and the New Jersey angle, that would be what I'd go for. Tony Pro had the most, you know, animosity, and he was more likely than anybody to do it. But all the mob bosses had to agree on that one. They had to agree. Oh. You just don't go kill Jimmy Hoffa on a whim. So,
can you believe that? And a lot of people, speaking of those coffee people that you know learned about the River Key from your website, a lot of people, you know, younger people, the name Hoffa. But as you know, Gary, one time, man, Jimmy Hoffa.
He had an easy to remember name, I think.
Maybe he was huge.
It's like Mickey Mantle, you know. Got a cool name, easy to remember name, everybody remembers it, but he was huge. He was so huge that Richard Nixon pardoned him. That's why he was out of the penitentiary after they pulled out all the stops and put him in jail, and he was proven to be a corrupt union leader. But when you're a union leader, you can control votes. So Richard Nixon pardoned him.
Unbelievable. And to this day, 1975 to now, it's still being debated who did it. It's like the Bugsy Siegel killing. And it's amazing how a lot of these mob, these big, high-level, high-profile mob killings still aren't, fully resolved. It's
Charlies.
Interesting.
We're back to the 1950s people talk about and wonder who killed the two Charlies. I get that question every once in a while from older people, if I had any idea. Right.
In Kansas City.
That caused the keep-offer hearings to come to Kansas City, really, when they killed these two guys.
Yeah, because it was so high profile, and it was one of those shocking things that the country was shocked. Kansas City's an incredible mob town, Gary, and you, Terrence O'Malley, and some others, man. It's an amazing story, and again, your latest documentary, I was blown away by it.
I appreciate it. All right, think we ought to wind this down now. I'll do my little lead out. If you have a friend or a relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And if you want to read some good mob blogs, especially about the mob and culture, look for Larry Henry at themobmuseum.org, right? www.themobmuseum.org. And they got a lot of other information out there. If you're out in Las Vegas, you need to go to the Mob Museum. You need to call up Frank Collada when you're out there. Or just Google his name and look for Frank Collada's tour. We'll give him, Frank, a little plug. He's helped me by coming on the podcast several times. Don't forget to hit me up on my Venmo app, and you can buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer for a little bit to help support the podcast or make a donation. I've added some awards in my donation, Larry. You've already got all three of them, so you don't need them. But either of my movies, for $25, I'll give you either one of my two movies, or I'll give you a gift certificate to get the Kindle version of Leaving Vegas, my book. So I got that, and if you go higher than that, well, you'll be surprised what you get. I'll take care of you. I had a guy get hold of me. He says, "Man," he said, "you just really surprised me with all this stuff I got in the mail the other day," because he didn't know he's getting anything. But so anyhow, that's my plug for myself and that latest movie. It's on Amazon Prime, although I don't make a dime out of that. Then you know what I get out of that? Almost nothing, folks. So rent it for me. Get $1.99. Give me $1.99, and I'll get a buck off of that. But just go watch it, because I think it's worth watching. I'm proud of it, and I just want people to see it. And Larry, I appreciate your feedback on that, and I've gotten a lot of other compliments like that. You know, each one of my documentaries gets a little bit better. I've got another idea about one. We'll see if I can do another one. That last one, I said I was done, but I may have another one in me.
Documentaries are great, Gary. Right. It's always fun to be with you, Larry. Good night, Larry. Enjoyed it.
Talk to you later.
Good night, Gary.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.